briefly met Mary yesterday, and yesterday evening I had dinner with her. And I think she's real neat. I haven't heard much of her story, but it's people like Mary that gives me hope today, because she has over 20 years sobriety. And it's because of people like that that, you know, it tells me that this works. But I have to work it. I have to do things to achieve this. And I love hearing people's stories, because it lets me also know that I was not alone. And other people used to hurt, and they used to have problems, and they could work them out. And without any more further ado, I would like to introduce to you our speaker this morning, Shotgun Mary. And I'm sure...
I thought if I got a stool to stand on, y'all could remember me as the tall Texan. Before I begin my talk this morning, I want to tell you about my medallions that I'm wearing. This first medallion is the one my sponsor, Willie B., gave me on my 25th AA birthday last April. Thank you. And Willie has been my sponsor the last 7 or 8 years, because one of my sponsors died and one of them moved away. And even though I had been sober 18 years, I still felt that I needed a backup sponsor. And this medallion, well, I'll tell you, did any of you ever see the movie or the musical, The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas? Okay. This was taken from an incident that happened in Texas. There is a famous whorehouse in Texas called the Chicken Ranch at LaGrange, Texas. It has been in business for 64 years till a mean TV personality in Houston shut it down. And there's a lot of people think that was a dirty trick he did, too, by the way. But anyway, I've had my beads for several months and worn them, and I noticed some writing on my little medallion here, and I looked down and read it, and I say this little gray-haired prim woman, and I really ain't prim, I just look prim. I read this medallion and I started laughing, because on one side it says the Chicken Ranch, LaGrange, Texas, and on the other side it says good for all night. Oh, dear. My name is Mary, and I am an alcoholic. And I have been sober since April the 21st of 1964, one day at a time. And this miracle of sobriety, this amazing grace, is because of a divine and loving providence. My two beloved sponsors, Gloria P. and Lee H., because of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and because of people exactly like you. I grew up in the small Texas town of Breckenridge, and it's deep in the heart of Texas. And I always say I grew up with sandstorms, tumbleweeds, and rattlesnakes. But my mother and father were the social leaders of the church group in this town, and they entertained a lot. But being good Baptists, they didn't drink alcohol and they didn't serve alcohol. But they worked for it and they weren't against it. And my little friend's parents at the country club set drank alcohol, served alcohol, and it was all right. And I grew up in my formative years thinking alcohol was a beverage. And it ain't no soda pop. It ain't no Perrier water, however you say that. It's a mood-altering chemical formula, and it was so toxic to me, it almost cost me my life. Now, I am married, and since the beginning of time, I have been married to the same husband one day at a time. I'm the mother of two grown sons, and I thank God every day they're grown and raised. You taught me in AA that I could not live my sons' lives. The only life I could live was my own. And as a result of this, I let go of these sons, and they live their lives and tend to their business. I live my life and tend to my business, and we have a pretty good relationship. Now, I am a grandmother, but I ain't the babysitting kind of grandmother. The idea of baking cookies and entertaining grandchildren is just not the way I want to spend my day. And I belong to an old and honorable profession. I am a housewife. Now, I am not a member of the oldest profession. And it's a damn good thing. Considering my mean personality and how ugly I look, I would have starved to death. I was a senior in high school when I took my first drink, and it ended in complete disaster. I got drunk, I got sick, I threw up on everybody just like a flamethrower. And the next morning when I woke up with my first hangover, it was the first of 10,000, I thought, to God, I thought I was dying with that first hangover. But anyway, this was such a bad trip for me that I didn't drink anything for about the next 10 years. And in that 10 years, I had married. I was the mother of these two sons. And we were buying a new used home and a new used car, all on one salary. And there wasn't enough money left over for me to have help with my housework. And I hated housework, and I had an awful lot of housework to do. You know, Irma Bombeck says housework, if it's done right, can kill you. But I felt about housework like this little hippie bride. She told her best friend, she said, all housework is such a drag. She said, you wash the dishes and make up the beds, and 3 weeks later you have to do it all over again. Oh, I was trying to grade through a big iron one hot, humid Houston afternoon, and a friend came by and suggested a cold beer. And I remember thinking, well, it's just a beverage. And when I drank that beer that afternoon, alcohol did something for me. First, it made me feel like $1 million. And second, it gave me false energy. And I know on 2 beers I got through that big ironing and had dinner on the table and everything for my husband when he came in, and I thought, oh boy, I have found the answer. Oh Lord, had I found an answer. You know, it wasn't long till I was drinking 2 to 4 beers a day to get my housework done, 4 to 6 beers a day, 6 to 8 beers a day. I had the cleanest house in Houston. You know that old saying, oh, I was such a good housekeeper, I even put newspapers under the cuckoo clock. When I got up to 8 to 10 beers a day, I decided I would switch to bourbon. And within 2 years after taking that first drink of alcohol, I was in serious trouble with my alcoholism, only I didn't know that's what it was. And this is when I started experiencing a personality change. Did any of you ever have a personality change when you drank? Well, my personality change was so dangerous and so bizarre that my family had to take the firing pins out of all the guns in the house. I ain't called shotgun for nothing.
Now,
because when they would argue with me or accuse me or criticize me, they became the enemy. And in my insanity, I would try to shoot them. And I am described perfectly in the big book on page 21 in three sentences where it says, "The alcoholic does absurd, incredible, and tragic things while drinking. He is a regular Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. He is seldom mildly intoxicated. He is always more or less insanely drunk." And that describes me to a T. Now, in the beginning, they would hide the guns from me when they could tell I was getting in one of my spells. But I could always find them. Then they got to where they locked up all the ammunition from me out in the pump house under a great big lock. Well, they had me full for a while. But one morning I got up and got my husband off to work and these two sons off to school. I think one was in kindergarten at that time. And I was sitting in my living room rocking, watching the clock, because when it got straight up 9 o'clock, I was going to the liquor store, which took 15 minutes. Now, many a morning I had gotten up to the liquor store before it opened, and I would be waiting out there with those rhinos and those weirdos, and I felt humiliated. I was exactly like those winos. It was just a matter of degree. And while I was waiting for the clock to get 9 o'clock so I could walk in that liquor store like a lady and ask, get my 2 or 3 half pints of Old Crow, I was remembering how mean they had been to me the night before. They, all three of them, had tongues of vipers. And they wouldn't let me shoot them. And a very diabolical thought came to my mind while I was watching that clock. I thought, well, I know just what I'll do. I'll stop back by the hardware store and I'll buy my own ammunition. Which I did. But I didn't buy ordinary shells. I bought hollow points. You know, there's a controversy going on now where the police should be able to use all the force in their guns. And I came home from the liquor store and the hardware store and said, listen, this ammunition is not designed to wound or to wing. It is designed to devastate. And this little loving wife and mother came home from the liquor store and the hardware store with several boxes of devastating ammunition. I thought this was normal behavior. I was just protecting myself. Anyway, I knew what they'd do if they discovered what I'd done, so I started hiding these shells all over the house, upstairs and downstairs and under the stairs and in the drapes and under the carpets. And, you know, I've often wondered what those people thought we sold that house to. But after I had outsmarted an alcoholic husband and 2 small sons, I felt real smug. And nothing uneventful happened for several months. You know, I didn't always get out of control when I drank. Sometimes I drank and loved everybody, and sometimes I drank and was industrious, and sometimes I drank and peacefully passed out. But I never knew what was going to happen to me when I drank. But one afternoon, my husband and these 2 sons were out in the backyard, and they were pitching horseshoes, and they were having such a good time. And I was in the house drinking. My husband is a beer alcoholic, and the icebox is always full of cold beer. And I was drinking his beer, and then I'd go in my dresser drawer, and I'd take 2 or 3 slugs of Old Crow. Then I'd come back and chase it with his beer. And I want to tell you that I drank so much Old Crow before I got to AA 25 years ago, that's exactly what I look like 25 years ago. I'm just glad I didn't drink Old Granddad. Or Wild Turkey. Turkey. my husband came in and took one look at me, and he says, "Mary, how in the hell can you be so drunk on two beers?" I looked up at him so innocent-like. I said, "I don't know. It must be my metabolism." I didn't even know what that meant, but it sounded good. And when he said this to me, that's when that old mean spell started coming over me, and he got a beer and went back outside to have some fun, and I was resenting them having a good time out there. I didn't want anybody to have a good time when I wanted them not to have a good time. I didn't want them happy. And I remembered my little catch of shells. So that's when I got my .22 automatic rifle. I had won this in a poker game one night when I was drunk. And I had to pull out that thing, you know, so I could put the shells in it. And I fell down two or three. Incidentally, the irony of my shooting, my husband taught me to shoot, if I was going to shoot somebody, shoot to kill. Well, anyway, all I was going to do was just shake them up a little bit. So I went out on the back porch, and I just fired him to the ground two or three times. Beep, beep, beep. And I did accomplish my purpose. You never saw a covey of quail scattered. You know, one went east, and one went west, and one went over the cuckoo's nest. But one went behind the boat shed, and one went behind a great big oak tree, and one went behind the side of the house, and they were catcalling back and forth. I double-crossed them again, and what in the world to do? And they came to two conclusions. The first conclusion, that gun was loaded. The second conclusion was, so was I. So it was after this that they started taking the firing pins out of all the guns in the house. You know, one of the most insidious phases of our disease of alcoholism is sometimes, most times I think, we turn against those that we love and need the most. Because it was after this, when I felt threatened, that I would revert to the butcher knives and the meat cleavers and the ice picks. Many a morning I have gotten up to fix breakfast for my family, and I'd open the knife drawer, and there wouldn't be a knife in there, a beer opener, or anything in that drawer with a point or an edge on it. And Lord, my heart would just sink. And I'd make that long, slow walk down to my son's bedroom, never knowing what I was going to find. But when I checked them out, and they had all their ears and their noses and everything, oh, I was feeling a vast sigh of relief. And I was through each other their pillows. When I had found these butcher knives and this great big meat cleaver up under their pillows, I would know I had just been dreadful the night before. And I'd reach up under there to get a knife so I could go back and finish breakfast. And I'd take these knives and put them in the kitchen sink to run some water over them. And I had a window over my kitchen sink, and it faced out toward the east. And always about this time, the sun was rising. And I'll tell you, I had the sickest heart, the heaviest heart, and the sickest soul of any woman you will ever know. And I thought, you know, if there is a God, he is in sunrise. And I would look out the window, and I'd say, my God, I have done it again. What is the matter with me? I didn't know I had a disease called alcoholism that was causing this insane behavior. And it was along about this time the remorse and the guilt started the suicide attempts. And I tried to commit suicide so many times it just got to be old hat around our house. One evening my husband came in from work and he looked up at the gun and he says, "Mary, where's my shotgun?" And I said, "Well, it's upstairs." He said, "What's it doing upstairs?" And I said, "Well, I was planning to kill myself." And he undid his tie and brushed past me, and he said, "What again?" And once, you know, the speed limit used to be 70 miles an hour. And once I jumped out of a car, and it was going about 80 miles an hour. And I spent 8 days in the hospital after this little incident. And where I jumped out of this car, there were great big jagged pieces of concrete. There were broken railroad ties. There was all kinds of danger and peril in that ditch. And all I did, I bounced a couple of times and I just rolled end over end, you know. And I didn't break any bones, but I took the skin off of every joint of my body. I had abrasions all over me. And every morning, that old mean doctor, he liked to hurt people. Anyway, every morning he'd come in with a great big pair of tweezers. And he would want to, you know, we'd tweeze off the dead skin that had formed in the night so the new skin would heal. And every day for 8 days, I would scream in pain, and he would say, "Well, you had no business jumping." I said, "Well, hell, I know that now." But I knew that the law of averages was going to catch up with me and that I was going to succeed in killing myself. And I didn't want to die. I just didn't want to live this sick way I was living. And this is when I made a decision to go to the doctors and get checked out and find out what was the matter with me. So I went to an internist. And incidentally, this was the beginning of my prescription phase of my alcoholism. And before it was over, I took energizers, stabilizers, tranquilizers, barbiturates, and a lot of narcotics. Matter of fact, I took the whole drug spectrum. It was not at all for the druggist to call me and say, "Mrs. Monikers, there is a new product on the market." I thought perhaps it might help you. And I say, "Well, Mr. Black, you just send it up." Now, I never smoked pot, I never snorted cocaine, and I never used heroin for 3 reasons only. That's the medical profession, the pharmaceutical company, and the liquor industry. With these 3 organizations going for me, I didn't need anything else to get me through the day. But this doctor was interviewing me, and I told him, I said, "Now, I drink every day, and most days I get drunk. I might even be an alcoholic." Now, see, this was about 40 years ago. And he looked at me and smiled across the table, and he said, "Nonsense. A nice little woman like you couldn't be an alcoholic." I agreed with him 100%. But he ran all a whole battery of tests on me. He even did a spinal tap and liver function test. And when my liver function test came back perfect, he came in, he gloated, and he said, "See, you couldn't be an alcoholic because all alcoholics have liver damage." So much for the doctor's diagnosis. But he was alarmed about my suicide attempts, which he attributed to depression. And I was depressed when I woke up without something to get up on in the morning. And he started me on a weekly series of vitamin and hormone shots. And he put me on the amphetamine drug. Now, this is medication that is used for depression. It is also used in weight reduction. And I want you to know that I came home from that doctor's office with a clean bill of health, weighing 90 pounds, dripping wet, and a great big bottle of reducing medicine. I still remember the first time I took that first PET pill. Within 30 minutes after taking that amphetamine, my God, I thought I had been reborn. It was glory, hallelujah. I'll tell you what, I did 3 weeks work in one afternoon on that PET pill. And when my husband came in that evening from work, the boys met him at the back door and they said, "Oh, Daddy, Mother feels good." And once again, I thought I had found the answer. But this wonderful medication had a bad drawback to it. I was so exhilarated and happy, I couldn't sleep. There's some amphetamine takers in here, I can tell. And after I hadn't slept in two or three nights, I called the doctor to tell him about this, and God love his heart, he sure did want me to sleep. He sent me my first prescription for the sleeping pill. So for a while, I was getting up, taking my pep pill in the morning and taking my sleeping tablet at night, and I did all right for a while. But the icebox is still full of beer, and I'm still alcoholic. So I reach in there and I start drinking. And my pattern was I'd start on my husband's beer and then I'd go to the liquor store. And so I started drinking again. And I started losing control and I called the doctor about this. Well, he was so happy my depression had left me and that I was sleeping. And he thought the amphetamine, the speed run needed to be slowed down a little bit. And there was a brand new drug on the market called a tranquilizer. And he sent me a bottle and had the magic words on there, take as needed. So I was getting up in the morning, I was taking my pep pill, I was taking my tranquilizer through the day, my sleeping tablet at night, and of course it wasn't long till I was abusing all of these drugs. Long before the doctor says he coined that phrase, I was doing it. And the ice box is still full of beer. And I reach in there, and incidentally, I've been going every week now getting my vitamin and hormone shot. And I reach in there, and I start drinking again. Now, when I started drinking this time, oh, it was taking a dreadful toll of me, this alcohol and this medication. And I want to tell you that my naturally curly hair became limp and stringy. I've always been a little cross-eyed. And back in those days, I went around with one eye closed a lot. I had a green cast to my complexion, with tones, undertones of yellow, by the way. Now, if this wasn't bad enough, skinny, cross-eyed, and green, I was growing a fine hair on each side of my face and a very prominent mustache across my upper lip. Now, I don't know how long I had looked this way. But if I had been growing horns and a tail, my family wouldn't have said a word to me. They wouldn't want to do anything to upset Mother. And one afternoon I had to go someplace, and I had to fix my face. And this is when I made an amazing discovery. If you have a beard, you can't powder your face. I looked through that haze of powder and saw myself, and I thought, my God, surely I'm not supposed to be growing a mustache. And I took myself off to the doctor's office to show him this phenomenon. And back in those days, you didn't have to have an appointment. You just went to the doctor and he saw you. And I was waiting for him to come in and see me, and I was in shock, just like I said, but I had already resolved, well, I might have to start shaving every day. Horrible thought, by the way. And the doctor came in, and he turned my face from side to side, and he said, honey, I'm not worried about that on your face. It's caused from the hormone shots. He said, I want to know if you're growing any hair on your chest. This is the most insulting thing anybody ever asked me in my whole life. I started unbuttoning my blouse, and I got to this button, and the full import of what he asked me hit me, and I was blazing mad. And I looked up at him, and I said, I don't know, you son of a bitch. But I better not be. And you never saw a monkey looking for fleas the way I was trying to find one hair on my chest. But I was spared that indignity. But I want to tell you guys something here. This is the same equivalent as you guys going to a doctor that you trusted, and he was giving you treatment over several months, and lo and behold, one day, you started experiencing a 28-day female cycle. I can guarantee you would be upset. Now, I want to tell you guys something. Don't give up your premium, because hormone therapy and estrogen therapy are two different things. But I remember driving home and swearing to my... Of course, I couldn't take no damn hormone shots right then. But I remember driving home, and I said I was never going to drink again. My God, that was it. And, of course, within 30 minutes, I was drinking again, and I didn't know what I was going to do. Well, it was along about this time they were writing a lot of articles in the leading magazines and the leading newspapers about Alcoholics Anonymous and about the disease of alcoholism. And oh, I tell you, I read every one of these three or four times upside down, backward. And I was interested in this. I wasn't one, of course, but I was interested. And I made a decision that I was going to the library and research this alcoholism. Now, you can believe it or not, I said, in case I ever get it, I'll know what it is. And in the library, there were two books on alcoholism. One was a book entitled Drinking is Not the Problem. And the other book was the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know which one I read first. I never will forget this guy. He'd been living with a nagging wife for 11 years, and he got drunk every day. As soon as he got a divorce, he hadn't had a drink in over 2 years. And I read that, and I thought, well, of course. Of course, it's all my husband's fault. I'll divorce him, and I can get all right. But right along behind that thought came another thought. Oh, Lord, if I quit Lenora, I'll have to get a job. I had sense enough to know I was totally unemployed at that time. But in reading in the big book, they said it was the physical, emotional, and spiritual. Well, they couldn't find anything wrong with me physically. And I thought, well, it's spiritual. I'll go back to church. And I didn't have it, but I was going to try it anyway. I'll go back to church and I'll get all right. And I went to my church and I still got drunk. I went to other denominations. I still got drunk. I went downtown, got special counseling from these ministers in these big churches downtown. I still got drunk. And incidentally, I always stop and say that I would go to get counseling from a Methodist minister, and I'm a dyed-in-the-wool Baptist. And that's just almost blasphemy. But these were rewarding experiences for me, and they'd always hold my hand, we'd stand up and bow, and he'd pray over me and everything, and I just feel real good till I passed the liquor store, and there I was off and running again. And I still didn't know what I was going to do. But the only weekend in our drinking that my husband was out of town, it was a cold February, by the way, and the boys were in the front of the house entertaining themselves, and I was in the back drinking, and we had an agreement they'd leave me alone if I would leave them alone. And I came to about 6 o'clock, and my conscience was just killing me. I thought, I'm going to fix these boys something good to eat. And I went in the kitchen, and I got an egg out of the icebox. I don't know which one it was. Anyway, I got it out, and I dropped it on the floor. Of course, I didn't have any shoes on, and every time I tell this story, I can still feel that egg between my toes. I reached in the icebox and got another egg and dropped it on the floor. And I remember looking down at those two eggs splattered all over the kitchen floor, and I thought, Lord, I'm too drunk to cook. I'll take the boys to the drive-in. I wasn't too drunk to drive. And on the way back from the drive-in, I missed my driveway and got stuck in the ditch in front of my house. You know, it had been raining, by the way, for days. And I started raving and ranting. The boys jumped out of the car and ran next door. And I still can't. I buried it way up past the hubs trying to get it out of that ditch. And I lived on a dead-end street, and there were four other families on this street, and our children played together. And I took, I was the chauffeur. I took all the kids to school every day and picked them up. And I liked these women pretty good when I was sober. But when I was drunk, I just couldn't stand them. And you know whose fault it was. My car was stuck out there in that damn ditch. It was all their fault. And I got out of my car in a loud screaming voice, and I cursed these women. I called them everything I could think of in the books. And when I was drunk and in a rage, I had the vocabulary of a mule skinner. And then came the dawn. Oh, I woke up. The house was cold. Doors were wide open. It had rained in. I went to close the back door, and I saw the eggs on the kitchen floor. And I remembered the eggs, and I thought, oh, my God. Went to the front door to close it and saw my car, and I said, two, oh, my gods, I remembered what I had done the night before. And I knew what I had to do. I had to go around the next morning and, you know, and apologize to these ladies. A miracle happened overnight because the next morning they were ladies. And I went to each one of them and I told them that I had gotten drunk the night before. I was ashamed of myself, and I asked them to forgive me. Now, this was the first time that my drinking had gone outside the confines of my home in several years, because 4 or 5 years previously, in my husband's job, we had to go to a lot of social functions, and almost invariably, I would start a scene at these functions. And it wouldn't be with some little woman or some little skinny guy. It would be with some 6'5" fellow. And, of course, my husband's 5'8", and he has to defend my honor when I get my toe in the crack, you know. He brought me home one night, and he sat me down, and he says, Mary, I will never take you out in public again because you are going to get me killed. And so this was the first time my drinking had gone outside the confines of my house or my yard. And several of the doctors that I, of course, I had made the rounds of all the doctors, the medical profession, trying to find some kind of help, but several of these doctors had suggested that perhaps a psychiatrist might help me. And it was after this incident that I was willing to go to a psychiatrist. I know I called him on Monday morning. And I was sitting in his office right early Tuesday morning. And when I was thinking about going to a psychiatrist, it's kind of scary the first time you think about going to a psychiatrist. But I tell you, I wanted help so bad I even thought about lying. Thinking I might get help if I make it more pressing, you know. But I do know I told him everything I could think about me. I told him about my sexual fantasies. I told him about my erotic dreams. I did not leave a stone unturned in my effort to seek help. And I know he was sitting behind his desk, and while I was talking, he had his hands up like this. And every time I would tell him something kind of racy, he'd do his hands like this. But he made a decision in February of 1949. That's before half of you people in this room were even born. He made a decision to put me in Herman Hospital to take a series of insulin shock treatments. He wanted me to take 60, but we couldn't afford but 30, and my mother had to pay for some of that. these shock treatments are brutal. They are the worst things I could ever think of having to go through. But if this was the price I had to pay to get well, I was willing to pay any price. And before I got to AA, I had over 100 shock treatments. And the psychiatrist would come in every morning and visit with me and every evening, and we just got to be real good buddies. And I'd been in there about 3 weeks, and he came in one morning and he says, Mary, I have some real good news for you. said, you don't have anything to worry about. You are not an alcoholic. So much for the psychiatrist's diagnosis. And I wasn't happy with this diagnosis, but it was all I had. But I do know this, because of this diagnosis, I drank for 15 more long, sick, bitter, humiliating years, getting sicker all the time. And it was after then. Incidentally, I gained 20 pounds in the hospital, and I had to borrow somebody's clothes so I could get home on. But within 6 weeks, I was back skinny, drinking again. And after this, I tried chiropractors, I tried psychologists, I tried mental health association people, I tried a faith healer, I tried a hypnotist. I would have tried voodoo, hoodoo, embraced any creed or any religion to have gotten rid of whatever this was that was killing me. And one of the psychologists working with my medical doctor put me on the drug Antabuse. Did any of you ever take Antabuse? Well, this is medication that if it's in your bloodstream and you drink, it will make you violently ill and it could cause death. Now, when I first started taking Antabuse, you had to be free of alcohol for 72 hours. We'd like to have never gotten that first Antabuse tablet out of me. And then they got it down. Finally, the last was 12 hours after my last drink. It was safe to take an Antabuse. And you see, I was drinking against my will. I didn't want to drink, and I hadn't wanted to drink for 10 years. But I'd get up in the morning, I'd look at the clock, and I'd think, well, maybe I can take an Antabuse. And in a weak moment, I'd take an Antabuse tablet. And sometimes within 15 to 30 minutes, the compulsion to drink would come over me, and I would just get panic-stricken. And I'd go in the kitchen, I'd get a great big glass of hot salt water, and I'd drop it down, and I'd go in the bathroom, stick my finger down my throat, trying to throw up that Antabuse so I could drink that day. Sick. I have taken alcohol with Antabuse, and I've had a violent reaction to it. But I'd also threatened to commit suicide by taking all the Antabuse while I was drinking. And my family got rid of that bad Antabuse from me. I've heard of alcohol, you know, I've heard of them hiding the alcoholic bottle, but Antabuse? But now things start turning around. It was in the early spring of 1962. I had to go to Wichita Falls, Texas to a wedding. And at the reception after this wedding, I was visiting with an aunt from another city. And as I turned to walk away from Aunt Sydney, she called out to me and said, Mary, by the way, your cousin Gloria is moving to Houston. Said she is in AA now and she is just doing beautiful. When Aunt Sydney called these words out to me, a hush fell over that room. Everything got so still you could have heard a pin drop. And in that moment of quiet, something way deep inside of me said, I am going to be saved. Somehow or another, I was given the knowledge through Gloria and AA, I was going to be made whole again. But you know, you'd think as long as I'd been trying everything, every place I could turn, I'd come back to Houston, get in touch with Gloria, get an AA, and everything would be fine. But I had some more drinking to do. When I did finally get in touch with her, she hadn't talked to me 2 minutes, and she said, well, Mary, you are an alcoholic. And you know, a weight lifted from my shoulders. I knew she was right. This was the first accurate diagnosis I had had of my condition in 20 years. But you know, I didn't want to go to AA. I wanted her to keep me sober over the telephone. And she said it did some money. And she talked to me for 13 months before I would go to my first AA meeting, and she would scare the liver out of me. She would say I had a disease that was progressive, it was incurable, and it terminates fatally. She would say, as an alcoholic, you have three choices. You can end up in jail, incarcerated, you can end up dead in a cemetery, or you can stay sober. And the thought of staying sober was so appalling to me, I'd have to get drunk again. And I'd say, Gloria, I'm not drinking, I'm taking Antabuse. And she'd say, well, honey, ordinary social drinkers don't have to take Antabuse to not drink. And I said, well, I've never been in jail. I've never been involved in an automobile wreck. You know, and I've never been in a mental institution. All those damn shock treatments didn't count. But it was on September the 23rd of 1963 that I tried to commit suicide in a blackout. Now, this scared me so bad, and I had a bad attitude about it, too. I thought, if I'm going to commit suicide, if I'm going to kill myself, I'm going to know about it. I don't want to wake up the next morning dead. And that was that night I got on the telephone and I called Gloria and I said, Gloria, I need help. And she, 13 months later, she said, yes, honey, we have been fooling around about this long enough. And on September the 23rd, 1963 was the night that Gloria and Lee came out and made a press set call on me. They made one on my husband too. But he said he'd stay up just to be polite to them. But while I was waiting for Gloria and Lee to get there, I had an awful bad habit on some of my drunks. I didn't want to take a bath. I didn't want to clean up. I didn't want to comb my hair. And this irritated my husband to no end. He's such a fastidious alcoholic, he takes showers during blackouts. To me, that was revolting. And one afternoon, I hadn't had a bath in 3 or 4 days, and he made a fatal mistake. He decided he was going to give me a shower. So when he took me in the bathroom and locked the door, I didn't know he was going to give me a bath. And when he started undressing me, I sure didn't know he was going to give me a bath. When he got me completely undressed and shoved me in that shower, that was quite a surprise. I came out of there like a mad wet hen. It was push and shove for a while. Finally, he got in the shower with me, clothes and all. And he got behind me, and he's holding me like this, and he's trying to soak me. And he said, by God, I'm going to give you a bath. And I said, by God, you're not. And I started kicking, and I kicked all 3 sides of that shower door. I just demolished that shower. And he was building it up, trying to repair it the next day, and he said, looked at me so sick and hung over, and he said, I'll never try to give you another bath. I said, that's a wise decision. But 2 or 3 weeks later, our boys were out on the back porch, and they were bored. All the kids in the neighborhood had something to do with them. And they were grumbling, and one of them said, oh, I wish something interesting would happen around here. One of them brought me and said, say, maybe Daddy will try to give Mama another bath. But when I opened the door to Gloria and Lee that night, they were the most beautiful sight I have ever seen. First of all, they were clean. They were smiling. They were happy, and they were sober. And whatever it was they had, I wanted. And we were visiting, and Lee caught my attention. We had been there a little while. He said, Mary, if you could be granted one wish tonight above all others, what would you ask for? And without a moment's hesitation, I said, I want peace of mind. To me, that was a treasure of all treasures. He said, you want serenity? And I said, yes, I do. You know, we're told in the promises that we will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. And I have serenity in my life today. Of course, I got mad at my husband last night on the telephone, but I have serenity most of the time. But I started into AA, and I stayed sober 90 days, and I was going to Travis Club on December 23rd, 1963, and get my 90-day check. And my mother-in-law came to see me 2 days before Christmas. You know, it came on the 20th, I think. And that's enough to get anybody drunk. My mother-in-law's enough to get anybody drunk. But my husband came in that evening from he came in AA to get me sober, so I wouldn't be sick all the time. He wouldn't have all these doctor bills and liquor bills. And then he was going on about his business, and he didn't know at that time you could be an alcoholic on beer. So he came in that evening with a fist of whiskey under each arm. He'd failed his first Christmas party. And I want to tell you that I do not remember to this day starting to drink. I'd been sober 90 days, but when I saw those two fists of whiskey, I went into a blackout. And I woke up Christmas Eve, drunk, sick, and it was the first Christmas my little grandson had come to spend Christmas with grandmother, and grandmother was drunk. And Lee called us a couple of days after Christmas, and he said he would be out that night. And I remember thinking, if he's going to come all the way from where he lived to where I lived to help me stay sober, I'm going to do my part. And I had started drinking beer, and I had just had two beers, and I woke my son up, and he'd gone off to college, and I woke him up, and I told him to take my car keys and to get rid of that beer. If that man was going to come out to help me stay sober that night, I wanted to do my part. And by the grace of God, I was able to, I didn't have to finish that drinking, which was a miracle. And we came out that night, and I started back in AA. And 3 or 4 months later, I looked up in a, we had some 80-foot trees in our backyard, and I looked up there, and I saw a brown paper sack way up in the tip top of one of those trees. And I puzzled over it. I thought, surely little squirrels couldn't carry a paper sack up that high. And then it dawned on me that little boy had climbed all the way up that tree to keep his mother from drinking that day. He was the one that had the stuff in my pathological drinking. The oldest boy went away to school 5 years earlier than he did. And anyway, I started back in AA again. And I stayed sober 109 days, I said. And then I don't ever want to forget drinking after 109 days of tobacco. I don't ever want to forget that last day of drinking. That's the most horrible day that I ever went through in my whole life. There's no nightmare that can describe the fear that I felt that day. And I knew if I started drinking that day, I would never get back to AA. I would never sober up again the longest day I lived. And Gloria stayed in touch with me all day, and she'd call and she'd say, "Honey, hang on. Honey, don't drink." And I would say, "All I have to do is drink two beers, and this nightmare will go away." But like I said, I knew if I started drinking that day, I would never sober up on the longest day I lived. She finally got in that afternoon. That was the most horrible day of my life. She came in that afternoon, and she couldn't find anybody to come get me and take me to a meeting. Finally, she got me on the phone, and she said, "Now, Mary, I'm going to tell you what you're going to do, and don't protest, just do it." She said, "You're going in your bedroom, and you're going to get down on your knees, and you're going to ask God to get you to an AA meeting tonight." And she added one more important sentence. She said, "And He will give you this strength." And I didn't have any place to turn. My back was absolutely to the wall. And this was the night I buried Gloria's faith. When I went in my bedroom and I got down on my knees, and all I said was, "Dear God, give me the strength to get to an AA meeting tonight." Now, I didn't know it at the time I knelt in prayer, the first honest prayer of my whole life, that was the moment that God started healing this shattered wound. Because from the time I rose from my knees, I have never had a compulsion to drink. God took it away from me that night. When we got down to the Travis Club that night, I didn't want to walk in the door and face everybody. I had gotten drunk twice. You know, when anybody in AA drinks, everybody knows it. It's just like the beat of a tom-tom drum right in the jungle. And I didn't want to walk in that door. And if Gloria hadn't been by my side, I never would have walked in that door. But she took my hand and she said, "Honey, this is not the end, it is just the beginning." And we walked in the door. And it was truly the beginning. After the meeting, a man came up and put his arm around me and he said, "Honey, the only important thing is you have come back. So just remember that if you have trouble, just come back to AA." You know, when I got dried out and didn't have alcohol to hide everything, I had to start looking at my defects of character, and I didn't like what I saw at all. And one of the most glaring defects I had was I was so sick, I was unable to give love to anyone. I was dead inside. I had abused myself so long, so much, that I was completely dead inside. And it worried me that I couldn't give you love. And Gloria said, honey, I was sober 6 months before I'd even say the Lord's Prayer with everybody. But anyway, Gloria said, talk to people. Well, I was scared to talk to people. Just scared to death. She said, well, just read and pray on your knees. So I started reading, and I read, came across a man in AA that felt just like I did. He was too dead inside to love anybody. And he said a prayer. He borrowed it to somebody, and I borrowed it from him. And every night when I would go to bed, I would say, dear God, give me a small love to give, a small understanding, and a small love of which I might be worthy. And I don't have to tell you that that prayer has been answered 1,000 times over. I didn't know who this guy was I was praying to. He was keeping me sober 24 hours a day, and I was having a hard time. You know, it's one thing. I will never believe that I was created from some man's cotton-picking rib. But I was trying to find John. And I talked to Gloria and Lee about where in the hell was he, you know. And they said, anyway, I came across something I read by an old 17th century philosopher named Pascal, and this was a turning point in my search for God. And all it said at the bottom of the page, limned in black, was, sweat not thyself. If you had not found me, you would not seek me. And I held on to that, and I thought, you know, if he's right, fret not thyself, if you had not found me, you would not seek me. I thought, well, I had already found God, and this was the beginning of a very slow, slow spiritual growth in this woman, and it's still going slow, but it's coming along. And this concept of living one day at a time was way over my head. That was one of the hardest things I had. I didn't think I was ever going to learn it. And I came across something. What I was going to do, I was going to be happy in the future. I was going to be happy when the car was paid for. I was going to be happy when school started, especially school started. But I came across something by Carl Sandburg. You've all heard it. If life is like an onion, you peel it back one layer at a time, and sometimes you weep. And I thought, well, being a housewife and a cook and everything, I could kind of buy that, and that's how I learned to slowly live one day at a time. And I do know one thing about living today at a time. I know today is a precious gift, and all I have to do is untie the ribbon. Thank you. And 28 days after I took my last rent, my husband asked if he could come into AA for his sake. And he's been sober 25 years last May. Thank you. My husband is a fishing addict. He is a complete and utter nut about fishing. One time he had a cleft step follower and he took the guy fishing. I never did know what happened to that guy. But anyway, I didn't get to see the hills of Rome, you know, or the Eiffel Tower. I got to go fishing when he had a vacation, or any time off. We always got to go fishing. So he was on vacation, we'd been fishing about 3 days, and he had just beat the socks off of me for 3 days in a row. And the fourth day he said, are you going fishing with me tomorrow? And I said, hell no, Bobby. I've got something better to do than go up there and let you beat me. And he said, well, that's all it was said, but I opened the gate for him to pull the boat out. And he stopped and he said, you sure you don't want to go fishing with me? I looked and I said, yeah, let me go get my fishing hat. So I ran in the house to get this old disreputable fishing hat. And I knelt down real fast by the side of the bed and I said, I said, pray, my dear God, protect my home from tigers and let me beat my mouth catching fish. We were fishing a couple of hours, and I had him beat. I had about nine. We fished for crappie, by the way. I had about nine, and he had about four. I said, well, now let's go. He said, nope, so we fished a little while longer, and I was afraid he was going to catch up with him. And I said, well, now let's go. And he said, no, I got to beat you catching fish. I was going to ruin his reputation. And I said, you just forget all about that boy. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, when I said my prayer this morning, I asked God to let me beat you catching fish. He gave me the meanest look. He took his hat off and threw it in the boat, and he said, married by God, that is dirty truth. Oh, I left out a very 26 years previous to coming into AA, I had made the mistake of my life. I had married a mother's only son. Oh, gals, if you want some advice, talk to me after the meeting. She didn't gain a daughter, boy. She lost a son, and she made me pay for it. She was a barracuda. And I could do nothing to please that old woman. Nothing at all. Everything I did was wrong. And I would complain about this old woman. Just complain highly of just Gloria and Lee. Finally, Gloria had enough of it. She says, Mary, if you don't quit hating that old woman, you are going to get drunk. And this got my attention. This scared me pretty good. And I said, now just how am I going to do this? And she said, well, you aren't going to like it. And I said, well, tell me. She said, well, you're going in your room and get down on your knees and you're going to pray for this old woman. And she added, and I said, the hell I will. And she added one more important sentence. She said, you're not going to pray for this old woman for her sake. You're going to pray for this old woman for your sake. So I went in my bedroom, and this is the hardest thing I have ever had to do in my AA life. I have a special place by my bed where I say my prayers, and to me it is sacred. And when I got ready to pray for this old woman, I got clear around the foot of the bed, up the other foot of the bed, and clear up in the corner. I didn't want to contaminate my good prayer life. And I got down on my knees. And I said, now, dear God, you know I don't mean a word I say, but you bless Ethel. And I got to pray at the end of my prayers every night. I said, bless Ethel. And 8 or 9 months later, I woke up one morning and I could tell that something was different. And I didn't know what it was. And I went searching all through the house to see if there was a fire or something, but something was different that morning. And I walked through the house about the third time, and I stopped in the living room, and my heart started smiling, because that was the first time that I no longer hated that old woman. God had taken this resentment and hatred away from me, and I no longer gave her the power to ruin my days, you know. I want to tell you, she didn't change one damn bit. But she didn't have to change. I am the one that had to change. I'm going to tell you about my picture, and then I'm going to tell you about the other few things, and I'm going to close this down. A friend of mine, I hadn't been sober about 60 days, I don't really know how long it was, and she called from Wichita Falls and wanted to know if she could come down. She wanted to shop for crystal in China. And I said, sure, Virginia, come on down. I've been sick. It took me over 2 years to recover from this disease that I had done, you know, this disease of my alcoholism, and So I hung up from Virginia. Went in then I told Lenore, I said, Lenore, isn't that the silliest thing? Somebody come 500 miles by Christian in China. These things meant nothing to me then. They don't mean anything to me now. And one other thing, I hate to shop. My husband doesn't know what a little treasure he has in me, does he? But anyway, Virginia came down and I took her to a nice store in the Crystal and China department. I said, now you just shop to your heart's content. And I am going in the furniture store and get in a chair and I'm going to watch people. I love to watch people. And when I turned to go into the furniture department, there was a picture way at the back of the room. And it was as far from here as it is to that back wall. But that picture caught my eye. And the closer I got to that picture, the more beautiful it became. And I got up there, and it was a picture of roses. And that's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen in my life. And all I wanted, that picture. And the price was $139. And, Lord, we couldn't afford that much money then. But, you know, it wasn't important that I couldn't buy that picture. The important thing was I could want something again. It had been so long since I had wanted anything. And several weeks later, I had to go in a department store to get something. And there was a little mannequin up there that had a little black and white check tacked a raincoat on it. And I wanted that raincoat. And it was just $10.95. I could afford $10.95. So I bought that raincoat. It swallowed me whole, you know. But it's the only one they had. But I bought it, and I got home, and I started hemming it up. It had a lining, and I could hem it up. And when I got through sewing that last stitch in that raincoat, I looked out the window. I wanted to start raining right then. And it was over 3 weeks before it rained. You never saw an old graft farmer scan the skies for rain the way I did, so I could wear my new raincoat. One afternoon, I heard the pitter-patter of rain, and I thought, oh, boy, I'm going to Travis, and I'm going to wear my new raincoat. My garage is attached to my house, so I put on my new raincoat and got in my car and drove to Travis, and I hummed every step the way over there. I was just delighted. This was really the first time I wanted to go to AA. Heretofore, I had been going for therapy. And when I got to Travis, the Travis Club, I started to get out of my car, and my God, it was just a deluge downtown. Oh, it was raining so hard, and I saw how hard it was raining. I got back in the car and slammed the door, and I started laughing all by myself. I had been waiting 3 weeks to wear my new raincoat, and I didn't want to get it wet. I want you to know that I have been given such a wonderful life in AA. I couldn't even, in my wildest dreams, I didn't know it could be this good. And all the blessings, small and large, that have been given to me, oh dear, I'm in awe of all of these good things that have happened to me. I'm in awe of being here with all of you today. This is important, and I am in awe of this. And one of my greatest treasures in AA is sponsoring women. And I sponsor lots of women, and they keep me young, and they keep me thinking on myself, you know. And any time a woman asks me to be her sponsor, most times I feel like it's a gift from God. Every once in a while, you know, there's lemons in everything. But they have kept me sober all these years. They have kept me sober, but I love my AA life. I wouldn't trade places with anybody. Anybody in this room, I wouldn't trade places with you. But I'm going to close and tell you that my husband came to hear me talk one night at a new club. And a man walked up to him that didn't know him, and he's after I'd talked, and he said, and who might you be? My husband said, well, my name's Lenore, and I'm married to that pistolero over there. Before I tell you the rest of it, I just want to say in all of my singing and all of the reading and all of the praying and all of the meetings and all of the people, the most important lesson that has been given to me that I know so deep in my heart is just in two words, God is. But I want to tell you that my husband calls me his pistolero. I'm called Pistol Pete. I'm called Shotgun Mary. I'm called Fast Draw. And I'm going to close this morning by telling you that because of the grace of God and Alcoholics Anonymous, this pistol-packing mama has laid her pistols down. I thank you.
That was great. You know, I would just like to say that I'm so grateful this morning that I have a God who loves me, and I know that this morning. And it's only through His grace and the people in these rooms this morning that I'm able to stand here clean and sober. And for that, I am so very grateful. And I just love everyone here. I just love everyone. And Mary, on the behalf of our city and the mayor and the officials, we would like to present you with this honor, and I am so proud to give it, to be the Duchess of Paducah.
We have a couple announcements and I can remember them.